Chapter 23. "One more," says the guy from ESPN. It sounds more like an order than a request. And although Henry can't see the fellow, he knows this particular homeboy never played a sport in his life, pro or otherwise. He has the lardy, slightly oily aroma of someone who has been overweight almost from the jump. Sports is perhaps his compensation, with the power to still memories of clothes bought in the Husky section at Sears, and all those childhood rhymes like "Fatty, Fatty, 2x4, had to do it on the floor, couldn't get through the bathroom door." His name is Penniman. "Just like Little Richard," he told Henry when they shook hands at the radio station. "Famous rock and roller from back in the 50s? Maybe you remember him." "Vaguely," Henry said, as if he hadn't at one time owned every single Little Richard had ever put out. "I believe he was one of the founding fathers," Penniman laughed uproariously, and in that laugh Henry glimpsed a possible future for himself. But was it a future he wanted? People laughed at Howard Stern, too, and Howard Stern was a dork. "One more drink," Penniman repeats now. They are in the bar of the Oak Tree Inn, where Penniman has tipped the bartender $5 to switch the TV from bowling on ABC to ESPN, even though there's nothing on at this hour of the day except golf tips and bass fishing. "One more drink just to seal the deal." But they don't have a deal, and Henry isn't sure he wants to make one. Going national with George Rathbun as part of the ESPN radio package should be attractive, and he doesn't have any serious problem with changing the name of the show from Badger Barrage to ESPN Sports Barrage. It would still focus primarily on the central and northern areas of the country. But what? Before he can even get to work on the question, he smells it again. My Sin, the perfume his wife used to wear on certain evenings when she wanted to send a certain signal. Lark was what he used to call her on those certain evenings when the room was dark and they were both blind to everything but scents and textures and each other. Lark. "You know, I think I'm going to pass on that drink," Henry says. "Got some work to do at home, but I'm going to think over your offer, and I mean seriously." "Ah-ah-ah," Penniman says, and Henry can tell from certain minute disturbances in the air that the man is shaking a finger beneath his nose. Henry wonders how Penniman would react if Henry suddenly darted his head forward and bit off the offending digit at the second knuckle. If Henry showed him a little coolie country hospitality fisherman style, how loud would Penniman yell? As loud as Little Richard before the instrumental break of Tutti Frutti, perhaps, or not quite as loud as that? "Can't go till I'm ready to take you, Mr. I'm Fat But It No Longer Matters," tells him. "I'm your ride, you know." He's on his fourth gimlet, and his words are slightly slurred. "My friend," Henry thinks, "I'd poke a ferret up my ass before I'd get into a car with you at the wheel." "Actually, I can," Henry says pleasantly. Nick Avery, the bartender, is having a kick-ass afternoon. The fat guy slipped him $5 to change the TV channel, and the blind guy slipped him $5 to call Skeeter's taxi while the fat guy was in the bathroom making a little room. "Huh?" I said, "Actually, I can. Bartender?" "He's outside, sir," Avery tells him. "Pulled up 2 minutes ago." There is a hefty creak as Penniman turns on his bar stool. Henry can't see the man's frown as he takes in the taxi, now idling in the hotel turnaround, but he can sense it. "Listen, Henry," Penniman says, "I think you may lack a certain understanding of your current situation. There are stars in the firmament of sports radio. Damn right there are. People like the Fabulous Sports Babe and Tony Kornheiser make 6 figures a year just in speaking fees. 6 figures easy. But you ain't there yet. That door is currently closed to you. But I, my friend, am one hell of a doorman. The upshot is that if I say we ought to have one more drink, then bartender," Henry says quietly, then shakes his head. "I can't just call you bartender. It might work for Humphrey Bogart, but it doesn't work for me. What's your name?" "Nick Avery, sir." The last word comes out automatically, but Avery never would have used it when speaking to the other one, never in a million years. Both guys tipped him $5, but the one in the dark glasses is the gent. It's got nothing to do with him being blind, it's just something he is. "Nick, who else is at the bar?" Avery looks around. In one of the back booths, 2 men are drinking beer. In the hall, a bellman is on the phone. At the bar itself, no one at all except for these 2 guys. One slim, cool, and blind, the other fat, sweaty, and starting to be pissed off. No one, sir. There's not a lady lark, he's almost said. There's not a lark. Nope. Listen here, Penniman says, and Henry thinks he's never heard anyone so unlike Little Richard Penniman in his entire life. This guy is whiter than Moby Dick, and probably about the same size. We've got a lot more to discuss here. A lot more to discuss is how it comes out. Unless you're trying to let me know you're not interested. Never in a million years, Penniman's voice says to Henry Layden's educated ears. We're talking about putting a money machine in your living room, sweetheart, your very own private ATM, and there ain't no way in hell you're going to turn that down. Nick, you don't smell perfume. Something very light and old-fashioned, my sin, perhaps. A flabby hand falls on Henry's shoulder like a hot water bottle. The sin, old buddy, would be for you to refuse to have another drink with me. Even a blind man could see the suggest you get your hand off him, Avery says. And perhaps Penniman's ears aren't entirely deaf to nuance, because the hand leaves Henry's shoulder at once. Then another hand comes in its place, higher up. It touches the back of Henry's neck in a cold caress that's there and then gone. Henry draws in breath. The smell of perfume comes with it. Usually scents fade after a period of exposure, as the receptors that caught them temporarily deaden. Not this time, though. Not this smell. No perfume, Henry almost pleads. The touch of her hand on his neck he can dismiss as a tactile hallucination. But his nose never betrays him. Never until now, anyway. I'm sorry, Avery says. I can smell beer, peanuts, this man's gin, and his aftershave. Henry nods. The lights above the back bar slide across the dark lenses of his shades as he slips gracefully off his stool. I think you want another drink, my friend, Penniman says, in what he no doubt believes to be a tone of polite menace. One more drink just to celebrate, and then I'll take you home in my Lexus. Henry smells his wife's perfume. He's sure of it, and he seemed to feel the touch of his wife's hand on the back of his neck. Yet suddenly it's skinny little Morris Rosen he finds himself thinking about. Morris, who wanted him to listen to Where Did Our Love Go as done by Dirty Sperm. And, of course, for Henry to play it in his Wisconsin rat persona. Morris Rosen, who has more integrity in one of his nail-chewed little fingers than this bozo has got in his entire body. He puts a hand on Penniman's forearm. He smiles into Penniman's unseen face and feels the muscles beneath his palm relax. Penniman has decided he's going to get his way. Again. You take my drink, Henry says pleasantly. Add it to your drink. And then stick them both up your fat and be-pimpled ass. If you need something to hold them in place, why, you can stick your job up there right after them. Henry turns and walks briskly toward the door, orienting himself with his usual neat precision and holding one hand out in front of him as an insurance policy. Nick Avery has broken into spontaneous applause, but Henry barely hears this, and Penniman he has already dismissed from his mind. What occupies him is the smell of my sin perfume. It fades a little as he steps out into the afternoon heat. But is that not an amorous sigh he hears beside his left ear? The sort of sigh his wife sometimes made just before falling asleep after love. His Rhoda. His lark. Hello, the taxi? He calls from the curb beneath the awning. Right here, buddy. What are you, blind? As a bat, Henry agrees, and walks toward the sound of the voice. He'll go home. He'll put his feet up. He'll have a glass of tea. And then he'll listen to the damn 911 tape. That as-yet-unperformed chore may be what's causing his current case of the heebie-jeebies and shaky shivers, knowing that he must sit in darkness and listen to the voice of a child-killing cannibal. Surely that must be it, because there's no reason to be afraid of his lark, is there? If she were to return and haunt him, she would surely haunt with love, wouldn't she? Yes, he thinks, and lowers himself into the taxi's stifling back seat. Where to, buddy? Norway Valley Road, Henry says. It's a white house with blue trim standing back from the road. You'll see it not long after you cross the creek. Henry settles back in the seat and turns his troubled face toward the open window. French Landing feels strange to him today. Fraught, like something that has slipped and slipped until it is now on the verge of simply falling off the table and smashing to pieces on the floor. Say that she has come back. Say that she has. If it's love she's come with, why does the smell of her perfume make me so uneasy? So almost revolted. And why was her touch, her imagined touch, he assures himself, so unpleasant? Why was her touch so cold? After the dazzle of the day, the living room of Beezer's crib is so dark that at first Jack can't make out anything. Then, when his eyes adjust a little, he sees why. Blankets, a double thickness from the look, have been hung over both of the living room windows, and the door to the other downstairs room, almost certainly the kitchen, has been closed. He can't stand the light, Beezer says. He keeps his voice low so it won't carry across to the far side of the room, where the shape of a man lies on a couch. Another man is kneeling beside him. Maybe the dog that bit him was rabid, Jack says. He doesn't believe it. Beezer shakes his head decisively. It isn't a phobic reaction. Doc says it's physiological. Where the light falls on him, his skin starts to melt. You ever hear of anything like that? No. And Jack has never smelled anything like the stench in this room, either. There's the buzz of not one, but two table fans, and he can feel the cross-draft, but that stink is too gluey to move. There's the reek of spoiled meat, of gangrene and torn flesh. But Jack has smelled that before. It's the other smell that's getting to him. Something like blood and funeral flowers and feces all mixed up together. He makes a gagging noise, can't help it, and Beezer looks at him with a certain impatient sympathy. Bad, yeah, I know. But it's like the monkey house at the zoo, man. You get used to it after a while. The swing door to the other room opens, and a trim little woman with shoulder-length blonde hair comes through. She's carrying a bowl. When the light strikes the figure lying on the couch, Mouse screams. It's a horribly thick sound, as if the man's lungs have begun to liquefy. Something, maybe smoke, maybe steam, starts to rise up from the skin of his forehead. "Hold on, Mouse," the kneeling man says. "It's Doc." Before the kitchen door swings all the way shut again, Jack is able to read what's pasted to his battered black bag. Somewhere in America, there may be another medical man sporting a Steppenwolf Rules bumper sticker on the side of his physician's bag, but probably not in Wisconsin. The woman kneels beside Doc, who takes a cloth from the basin, wrings it out, and places it on Mouse's forehead. Mouse gives a shaky groan and begins to shiver all over. Water runs down his cheeks and into his beard. The beard seems to be coming out in mangy patches. Jack steps forward, telling himself he will get used to the smell. Sure he will. Maybe it's even true. In the meantime, he wishes for a little of the Vicks vapor rub most LAPD homicide detectives carry in their glove compartments as a matter of course. A dab under each nostril would be very welcome right now. There's a sound system, scruffy, and a pair of speakers in the corners of the room, huge, but no television. Stacked wooden crates filled with books line every wall without a door or a window in it, making the space seem even smaller than it is, almost crypt-like. Jack has a touch of claustrophobia in his makeup, and now this circuit warms up, increasing his discomfort. Most of the books seem to deal with religion and philosophy. He sees Descartes, C.S. Lewis, the Bhagavad Gita, Stephen Avery's Tenets of Existence. But there's also a lot of fiction, books on beer making, and, on top of one giant speaker, Albert Goldman's trash tome about Elvis Presley. On the other speaker is a photograph of a young girl with a splendid smile, freckles, and oceans of reddish-blonde hair. Seeing the child who drew the hopscotch grid out front makes Jack Sawyer feel sick with anger and sorrow. Otherworldly beings and causes there may be, but there's also a sick old fuck prowling around who needs to be stopped. He'd do well to remember that. Bear Girl makes a space for Jack in front of the couch, moving gracefully even though she's on her knees and still holding the bowl. Jack sees that in it are two more wet cloths and a heap of melting ice cubes. The sight of them makes him thirstier than ever. He takes one and pops it into his mouth. Then he turns his attention to Mouse. A plaid blanket has been pulled up to his neck. His forehead and upper cheeks, the places not covered by his decaying beard, are pasty. His eyes are closed. His lips are drawn back to show teeth of startling whiteness. Izzy, Jack begins, and then Mouse's eyes open. Whatever Jack meant to ask leaves his head entirely. Around the hazel irises, Mouse's eyes have gone an uneasy, shifting scarlet. It's as if the man is looking into a terrible, radioactive sunset. From the inner corners of his eyes, some sort of black scum is oozing. The Book of Philosophical Transformation addresses most current dialectics, Mouse says, speaking mellowly and lucidly. And Machiavelli also speaks to these questions. Jack can almost picture him in a lecture hall, until his teeth begin to chatter, that is. Mouse, it's Jack Sawyer. No recognition in those weird red and hazel eyes. The black gunk at the corners of them seems to twitch, however, as if it is somehow sentient, listening to him. It's Hollywood, Beezer murmurs. The cop, remember? One of Mouse's hands lies on the plaid blanket. Jack takes it and stifles a cry of surprise when it closes over his with amazing strength. It's hot, too, as hot as a biscuit just out of the oven. Mouse lets out a long, gasping sigh, and the stench is fetid, bad meat, decayed flowers. He's rotting, Jack thinks, rotting from the inside out. Oh, Christ, help me through this. Christ may not, but the memory of Sophie might. Jack tries to fix her eyes in his memory, that lovely, level, clear, blue gaze. Listen, Mouse says. I'm listening. Mouse seems to gather himself. Beneath the blanket, his body shivers in a loose, uncoordinated way that Jack guesses is next door to a seizure. Somewhere a clock is ticking. Somewhere a dog is barking. A boat hoots on the Mississippi. Other than these sounds, all is silence. Jack can remember only one other such suspension of the world's business in his entire life, and that was when he was in a Beverly Hills hospital waiting for his mother to finish the long business of dying. Somewhere Time Marshall is waiting to be rescued, hoping to be rescued at least. Somewhere there are breakers hard at work trying to destroy the axle upon which all existence spins. Here is only this eternal room, with its feeble fans and noxious vapors. Mouse's eyes close, then open again. They fix upon the newcomer, and Jack is suddenly sure some great truth is going to be confided. The ice cube is gone from his mouth. Jack supposes he crunched it up and swallowed it without even realizing, but he doesn't dare take another. Go on, buddy, Doc says. You get it out and then I'll load you up with another hypo-a-dope. The good stuff. Maybe you'll sleep. Mouse pays no heed. His mutating eyes hold Jack's. His hand holds Jack's, tightening still more. Jack can almost feel the bones of his fingers grinding together. Don't go out and buy top-of-the-line equipment, Mouse says, and sighs out another excruciatingly foul breath from his rotting lungs. Don't. Most people give up brewing after a year or two. Even dedicated hobbyists. Making beer is not for pussies. Jack looks around at Beezer, who looks back impassively. He's in and out. Be patient. Wait on him. Mouse's grip tightens yet more, then loosens just as Jack is deciding he can take it no longer. Get a big pot, Mouse advises him. His eyes bulge. The reddish shadows come and go, fleeting across the curved landscape of his corneas. And Jack thinks that's its shadow, the shadow of the Crimson King. Mouse has already got one foot in its court. 5 gallons at least. You find the best ones are in seafood supply stores. And for a fermentation vessel, plastic water cooler jugs are good. They're lighter than glass, and I'm burning up. Christ bees, I'm burning up! Fuck this, I'm gonna shoot it to him, Doc says, and snaps open his bag. Beezer grabs his arm. Not yet! Bloody tears begin to slip out of Mouse's eyes. The black goo seems to be forming into tiny tendrils. These reach greedily downward as if trying to catch the moisture and drink it. Fermentation lock and stopper, Mouse whispers. Thomas Merton is shit. Never let anyone tell you different. No real thought there. You have to let the gases escape while keeping dust out. Jerry Garcia wasn't God. Kurt Cobain wasn't God. The perfume he smells is not that of his dead wife. He's caught the eye of the king. Gorg tenabala ilili. The Apopanax is dead. Long live the Apopanax. Jack leans more deeply into Mouse's smell. Who's smelling perfume? Who's caught the eye of the king?
The mad king, the bad king, the sad king, ring-a-ding-ding, all hail the king.
Mouse, who's caught the eye of the king? Doc says, I thought you wanted to know about who. Jack has no idea why this seems important to him, but it does. Is it something someone has said to him recently? Was it Dale? Tansy? Was it, God save us, Wendell Green?
Racking cane and hose, Mouse says confidentially. That's what you need when the fermentation's done, and you can't put beer in screw-top bottles.
You, Mouse turns his head away from Jack, nestles it cozily in the hollow of his shoulder, opens his mouth and vomits. Bear Girl screams. The vomit is pus yellow and speckled with moving black bits like the crud in the corners of Mouse's eyes. It is alive. Beezer leaves the room in a hurry, not quite running, and Jack shades Mouse from the brief glare of kitchen sunlight as best he can. The hand clamped on Jack's loosens a little more. Jack turns to Doc. Do you think he's going? Doc shakes his head. Passed out again. Poor old Mousy ain't getting off that easy. He gives Jack a grim, haunted look. This better be worth it, Mr. Policeman, 'cause if it ain't, I'm gonna replumb your sink. Beezer comes back with a huge bundle of rags, and he's put on a pair of green kitchen gloves. Not speaking, he mops up the pool of vomit between Mouse's shoulder and the backrest of the couch. The black specks have ceased moving, and that's good. To have not seen them moving in the first place would have been even better. The vomit, Jack notices with dismay, has eaten into the couch's worn fabric like acid. I'm going to pull the blanket down for a second or two, Doc says, and Bear Girl gets up at once, still holding the bowl with the melting ice. She goes to one of the bookshelves and stands there with her back turned, trembling. Doc, is this something I really need to see? I think maybe it is. I don't think you know what you're dealing with, even now. Doc takes hold of the blanket and eases it out from beneath Mouse's limp hand. Jack sees that more of the black stuff has begun to ooze from beneath the dying man's fingernails. Remember that this happened only a couple of hours ago, Mr. Policeman. He pulls the blanket down. Standing with her back to them, Susan Bear Girl Osgood faces the great works of Western philosophy and begins to cry silently. Jack tries to hold back his scream and cannot. Henry pays off the taxi, goes into his house, takes a deep and soothing breath of the air-conditioned cool. There is a faint aroma, sweet, and he tells himself it's just fresh-cut flowers, one of Mrs. Morton's specialties. He knows better, but wants no more to do with ghosts just now. He is actually feeling better, and he supposes he knows why. It was telling the ESPN guy to take his job and shove it. Nothing more apt to make a fellow's day, especially when the fellow in question is gainfully employed, possessed of 2 credit cards that are nowhere near the max out point, and has a trio of cold iced tea in the fridge. Henry heads kitchenward now, making his way down the hall with one hand held out before him, testing the air for obstacles and displacements. There's no sound but the whisper of the air conditioner, the hum of the fridge, the clack of his heels on the hardwood, and a sigh. An amorous sigh. Henry stands where he is for a moment, then turns cautiously. Is the sweet aroma a little stronger now, especially facing back in this direction, toward the living room and the front door? He thinks yes. And it's not flowers. No sense fooling himself about that. As always, the nose knows. That's the aroma of my sin. Rhoda, he says. And then lower, Lark? No answer. Of course not. He's just having the heebie-jeebies, that's all. Those world-famous shaky shivers. And why not? Because I'm the sheik, baby, Henry says. The sheik, the shake, the shook. No smells. No sexy sighs. And yet, he's haunted by the idea of his wife, back in the living room, standing there in perfumed cerements of the grave, watching him silently as he came in and passed blindly before her. His Lark, come back from Noggin Mound Cemetery for a little visit. Maybe to listen to the latest Slobberbone CD. Quit it, he says softly. Quit it, you dope. He goes into his big, well-organized kitchen. On his way through the door, he slaps a button on the panel there without even thinking about it. Mrs. Morton's voice comes from the overhead speaker, which is so high-tech she might almost be in the room. Jack Sawyer was by, and he dropped off another tape he wants you to listen to. He said it was, you know, that man, that bad man. Bad man, right, Henry murmurs, opening the refrigerator and enjoying the blast of cold air. His hand goes unerringly to one of three cans of Kingsland lager stored inside the door. Never mind the iced tea. Both of the tapes are in your studio by the soundboard. Also, Jack wanted you to call him on his cell phone. Mrs. Morton's voice takes on a faintly lecturing tone. If you do speak to him, I hope you tell him to be careful, and be careful yourself. A pause. Also, don't forget to eat supper. It's all ready to go. Second shelf of the fridge on your left. Nag, 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 Henry says, but he's smiling as he opens his beer. He goes to the telephone and dials Jack's number. On the seat of the Dodge Ram, parked in front of One Nail House Row, Jack's cell phone comes to life. This time there's no one in the cab to be annoyed by its tiny but penetrating tweet. The cellular customer you are trying to reach is currently not answering. Please try your call again later. Henry hangs up, goes back to the doorway, and pushes another button on the panel there. The voices that deliver the time and temperature are all versions of his own, but he's programmed a random shuffle pattern into the gadget, so he never knows which one he's going to get. This time it's the Wisconsin rat, screaming crazily into the sunny air-conditioned silence of his house, which has never felt so far from town as it does today. Times 4:22 p.m. outside temperatures 82, inside temperatures 70. What the hell do you care? What the hell does anyone care? Chew it up, eat it up, wash it down. It all comes out the same place, right? Henry thumbs the button again, silencing the rat's trademark cry. How did it get late so fast? God, wasn't it just noon? For that matter, wasn't he just young, 20 years old, and so full of spunk it was practically coming out of his ears? What? That sigh comes again, derailing his mostly self-mocking train of thought. A sigh? Really? More likely just the air conditioner's compressor cutting off. He could tell himself that anyway. He can tell himself that if he wants to. Is anyone here? Henry asks. There is a tremble in his voice that he hates, an old man's palsied quaver. Is anyone in the house with me? For a terrible second, he is almost afraid something will answer. Nothing does. Of course nothing does. And he swallows half the can of beer in three long gulps. He decides he'll go back into the living room and read for a little while. Maybe Jack will call. Maybe he'll get himself a little more under control once he has a little fresh alcohol in his system. And maybe the world will end in the next 5 minutes, he thinks. That way you'll never have to deal with the voice on those damned tapes waiting in the studio. Those damned tapes lying there on the soundboard like unexploded bombs. Henry walks slowly back down the hall to the living room, with one hand held out before him, telling himself he's not afraid, not a bit afraid of touching his wife's dead face. Jack Sawyer has seen a lot. He's traveled to places where you can't rent from Avis and the water tastes like wine. But he's never encountered anything like Mouse Bauman's leg. Or, rather, the pestilential apocalyptic horror show that was Mouse Bauman's leg. Jack's first impulse, once he's got himself back under something like control, is to upbraid Doc for taking off Mouse's pants. Jack keeps thinking of sausages and how the casing forces them to keep their shape even after the fry pan's sizzling on a red-hot burner. This is an undoubtedly stupid comparison, primo stupido, but the human mind under pressure puts on some pretty odd jinks and jumps. There's still the shape of a leg there, sort of, but the flesh has spread away from the bone. The skin is almost completely gone, melted to a runny substance that looks like a mixture of milk and bacon fat. The interwoven mat of muscle beneath what remains of the skin is sagging and undergoing the same cataclysmic metamorphosis. The infected leg is in a kind of undisciplined motion as the solid becomes liquid and the liquid sizzles relentlessly into the couch upon which Mouse is lying. Along with the almost insupportable stench of decay, Jack can smell scorching cloth and melting fabric. Poking out of this spreading, vaguely leg-like mess is a foot that looks remarkably undamaged. If I wanted to, I could pull it right off, just like a squash off a vine. The thought gets to him in a way the sight of the grievously wounded leg hasn't quite been able to. And for a moment, Jack can only bow his head, gagging and trying not to vomit down the front of his shirt. What perhaps saves him is a hand on his back. It's Beezer, offering what comfort he can. The rowdy color has completely left the Beezer's face. He looks like a motorcyclist come back from the grave in an urban myth. You see, Doc is asking, and his voice seems to come from a great distance. This ain't the chicken pox, my friend, although it looked a little like that while I was still getting cranked up. He's already exhibiting red spots on his left leg, his belly, his balls. That's pretty much what the skin around the bite looked like when we first got him back here, just some redness and swelling. I thought, shit, ain't nothing to this. I got enough Zithromax to put this on the run before sundown. Well, you see what good the Zithro did. You see what good anything did. It's eating through the couch. And I'm guessing that when it finishes with the couch, it'll go right to work on the floor. This shit is hungry. So was it worth it, Hollywood? I guess only you and Mouse know the answer to that. He still knows where the house is, Beezer says. Me, I don't have a clue, even though we just came from there. You either, do you? Doc shakes his head. But Mouse, he knows. Susie, honey, Doc says to Bear Girl, bring another blanket, would you? This one's damn near it through. Bear Girl goes willingly enough. Jack gets to his feet. His legs are rubbery, but they hold him. Shield him, he tells Doc. I'm going out to the kitchen. If I don't get a drink, I'm going to die. Jack takes on water directly from the sink, swallowing until a spike plants itself in the center of his forehead, and he belches like a horse. Then he just stands there, looking out into Beezer and Bear Girl's backyard. A neat little swing set has been planted there in the weedy desolation. It hurts Jack to look at it, but he looks anyway. After the lunacy of Mouse's leg, it seems important to remind himself that he's here for a reason. If the reminder hurts, so much the better. The sun, now turning gold as it eases itself down toward the Mississippi, glares in his eyes. Time hasn't been standing still after all, it seems. Not outside this little house, anyway. Outside one Nail House Row, time actually seems to have sped up. He's haunted by the idea that coming here was as pointless as detouring to Henry's house, tormented by the thought that Mr. Munshun and his boss, the Abala, are running him around like a wind-up toy with a key in its back while they do their work. He can follow that buzz in his head to Black House, so why the hell doesn't he just get back in his truck and do it? The perfume he smells is not that of his dead wife. What does that mean? Why does the idea of someone smelling perfume make him so crazy and afraid? Beezer knocks on the kitchen door, making him jump. Jack's eye fixes on a sampler hung over the kitchen table. Instead of God Bless Our Home, it reads Heavy Metal Thunder, with a carefully stitched Harley Davidson beneath. Get back in here, man, the bee says. He's awake again. Henry's on a path in the woods. Or maybe it's a lane. And something is behind him. Each time he turns to see, in this dream he can see, but seeing is no blessing, there's a little more of that something back there. It appears to be a man in evening dress, but the man is frightfully elongated, with spike teeth that jut over a smiling red lower lip. And he seems, is it possible, to have only one eye. The first time Henry looks back, the shape is only a milky blur amid the trees. The next time he can make out the uneasy dark swim of its coat and a floating red blotch that might be a tie or an ascot. Up ahead of him is this thing's den, a stinking hole that only coincidentally looks like a house. Its presence buzzes in Henry's head. Instead of pine, the woods pressing in on either side smell of heavy, cloying perfume. My sin. It's driving me, he thinks with dismay. Whatever that thing back there is, it's driving me like a steer toward the slaughterhouse. He thinks of cutting off the lane to his left or right, of using the miracle of his new sight to escape through the woods. Only there are things there, too, dark, floating shapes like sooty scarves. He can almost see the closest. It's some sort of gigantic dog with a long tongue as red as the apparition's tie and bulging eyes. Can't let it drive me to the house, he thinks. I have to get out of this before it can get me there. But how? How? It comes to him with startling simplicity. All he has to do is wake up, because this is a dream. This is just it's a dream! Henry cries out and jerks forward. He's not walking. He's sitting. Sitting in his very own easy chair. And pretty soon he's going to have a very wet crotch, because he fell asleep with a can of Kingsland Lager balanced there, and... But there's no spill, because there's no can of beer. He feels cautiously to his right, and yep, there it is, on the table with his book, a Braille edition of Reflections in a Golden Eye. He must have put it there before first falling asleep and then falling into that horrible nightmare. Except, Henry's pretty sure he didn't do any such thing. He was holding the book, and the beer was between his legs, freeing his hands to touch the little upraised dots that tell the story. Something very considerately took both the book and the can after he dropped off and put them on the table. Something that smells of my sin perfume. The air reeks of it. Henry takes a long, slow breath with his nostrils flared and mouth tightly sealed shut. No, he says, speaking very clearly. I can smell flowers and rug shampoo and fried onions from last night, very faint but still there. The nose knows. All true enough, but the smell had been there. It's gone now because she's gone. But she will be back. And suddenly he wants her to come. If he's frightened, surely it's the unknown he's frightened of, right? Only that, and nothing more. He doesn't want to be alone here, with nothing for company but the memory of that rancid dream. And the tapes.
He has to listen to the tapes. He promised Jack. Henry gets shakily to his feet and makes his way to the living room control panel. This time he's greeted by the voice of Symphonic Stan, a mellow fellow if ever there was one. Hey there, all you hoppin' cats and boppin' kitties at the tone. It's 7:14 p.m. Boulevard watch time. Outside, the temp is a very cool 75 degrees, and here in the make-believe ballroom, it's a very nifty 70 degrees. So why not get off your money, grab your honey, and make a little magic? 7:14? When was the last time he fell asleep for almost 3 hours in the daytime? For that matter, when was the last time he had a dream in which he could see? The answer to that second question, so far as he can remember, is never. Where was that lane? What was the thing behind him? What was the place ahead of him, for that matter? Doesn't matter, Henry tells the empty room. If it is empty, it was a dream, that's all. The tapes, on the other hand, he doesn't want to listen to them. Has never wanted to listen to anything any less in his life. With the possible exception of Chicago singing Does Anybody Really Know What Time It Is? But he has to. If it might save Time Marshall's life, or the life of even one other child, he must. Slowly, dreading every step, Henry Layden makes his blind way to his studio, where two cassettes wait for him on the soundboard. In heaven there is no beer, Mouse sings, in a toneless, droning voice. His cheeks are now covered with ugly red patches, and his nose seems to be sinking sideways into his face, like an atoll after an undersea earthquake. That's why we drink it here, and when we're gone from here, our friends will be drinking all the beer. It's been like this for hours now. Philosophical nuggets, instructions for the beginning beer-making enthusiast, snatches of song. The light coming through the blankets over the windows has dimmed appreciably. Mouse pauses, his eyes closed. Then he starts another ditty. 100 bottles of beer on the wall, 100 bottles of beer. If one of those bottles should happen to fall, I have to go, Jack says. He's hung in there as well as he can, convinced that Mouse is going to give him something, but he can wait no longer. Somewhere, Time Marshall is waiting for him. Hold on, Doc says. He rummages in his bag and comes out with a hypodermic needle. He raises it in the dimness and taps the glass barrel with a fingernail. What's that? Doc gives Jack and Beezer a brief, grim smile. Speed, he says, and injects it into Mouse's arm. For a moment, there's nothing. Then, as Jack is opening his mouth again to tell them he has to go, Mouse's eyes snap wide. They are now entirely red, a bright and bleeding red. Yet when they turn in his direction, Jack knows that Mouse is seeing him, maybe really seeing him for the first time since he got here. Bear Girl flees the room, trailing a single diminishing phrase behind her. No more, no more, no more, no more. Fuck, Mouse says in a rusty voice. Fuck, I'm fucked, ain't I? Beezer touches the top of his friend's head briefly but tenderly. Yeah, man, I think you are. Can you help us out? Bit me once, just once, and now, his hideous red gaze turns to Doc. Can barely see you. Fucking eyes are all weird. You're going down, Doc says. Ain't gonna lie to you, man. Not yet I ain't, Mouse says. Give me something to write on, to draw a map on. Quick. Dunno you shot me with, Doc, but the stuff from the dog's stronger. I ain't gonna be composed long. Quick. Beezer feels around at the foot of the couch and comes up with a trade-sized paperback. Given the heavy shit on the bookcases, Jack could almost laugh. The book is The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Beezer tears off the back cover and hands it to Mouse with the blank side up. Pencil, Mouse croaks. Hurry up. I got it all, man. I got it up here. He touches his forehead. A patch of skin the size of a quarter sloughs off at his touch. Mouse wipes it on the blanket as if it were a booger.
Beezer pulls a gnawed stub of pencil from an inside pocket of his vest. Mouse takes it and makes a pathetic effort to smile. The black stuff oozing from the corners of his eyes has continued to build up, and now it lies on his cheeks like smears of decayed jelly. More of it is springing out of the pores on his forehead in minute black dots that remind Jack of Henry's Braille books. When Mouse bites his lower lip in concentration, the tender flesh splits open at once. Blood begins dribbling into his beard. Jack supposes the rotted meat smell is still there, but Beezer had been right. He's gotten used to it. Mouse turns the book cover sideways, then draws a series of quick squiggles.
"Look it," he says to Jack. "This is the Mississippi, right?"
"Right," Jack says. When he leans in, he starts getting the smell again. Up close, it's not even a stench. It's a miasma trying to crawl down his throat. But Jack doesn't move away. He knows what an effort Mouse is making. The least he can do is play his part.
"Here's downtown. The Nelson. Lucky's. The Agincourt Theater. The Tap Room. Here's where Chase Street turns into Lyle Road, then Route 35. Here's Libertyville. The VFW. Goltz's. Oh, Christ!"
Mouse begins to thrash on the couch. Sores on his face and upper body burst open and begin leaking. He screams with pain. The hand not holding the pencil goes to his face and paws at it ineffectually. Something inside Jack speaks up, then speaks in a shining, imperative voice he remembers from his time on the road all those years ago. He supposes it's the voice of the talisman, or whatever remains of it in his mind and soul. It doesn't want him to talk. It's trying to kill him before he can talk. It's in the black stuff. Maybe it is the black stuff. You've got to get rid of it. Some things can only be done without the mind's prudish interference. When the work is nasty, instinct is often best. So it is without thinking that Jack reaches out, grasps the black slime oozing from Mouse's eyes between his fingers, and pulls. At first, the stuff only stretches, as if made of rubber. At the same time, Jack can feel it squirming and writhing in his grip, perhaps trying to pinch or bite him. Then it lets go with an audible twang sound. Jack throws the convulsing black tissue onto the floor with a cry. The stuff tries to slither beneath the couch. Jack sees this even as he wipes his hands on his shirt, frantic with revulsion. Doc slams his bag down on one piece. Beezer squashes the other with the heel of a motorcycle boot. It makes a squittering sound.
"What the fuck is that shit?"
Doc asks. His voice, ordinarily husky, has gone up into a near falsetto range.
"What the fuck?"
"Nothing from here," Jack says. "And never mind. Look at him. Look at Mouse." The red glare in Mouse's eyes has retreated. For the moment, he looks almost normal. Certainly he's seeing them, and the pain seems gone.
"Thanks," he breathes. "I only wish you could get it all that way, but man, it's already coming back. Pay attention."
"I'm listening," Jack says.
"You better," Mouse replies. "You think you know. You think you can find the place again, even if these two can't. And maybe you can, but maybe you don't know quite so much as you..." Ah, fuck!
From somewhere beneath the blanket, there is a ghastly bursting sound as something gives way. Sweat runs down Mouse's face, mixing with the black poison venting from his pores and turning his beard a damp and dirty gray. His eyes roll up to Jack's, and Jack can see that red glare starting to haze over them again.
"This sucks," Mouse pants. "Never thought I'd go out this way. Look at Hollywood."
The dying man draws a small rectangle on his makeshift scribble of map.
"This Ed's Eats, where we found Irma," Jack says. "I know." "All right," Mouse whispers. "Good. Now look, over on the other side, the Schubert and Gale side, and to the west."
Mouse draws a line going north from Highway 35. He puts little circles on either side of it. Jack takes these to be representations of trees. And across the front of the line, like a gate, no trespassing.
"Yeah," Doc breathes. "That's where it was, all right. Black house."
Mouse takes no notice. His dimming gaze is fixed solely on Jack.
"Listen to me, cop. Are you listening?"
"Yes."
"Christ, you better be," Mouse tells him.
As it always has, The work captures Henry, absorbs him, takes him away. Boredom and sorrow have never been able to stand against this old captivation with sound from the sighted world. Apparently, fear can't stand against it either. The hardest moment isn't listening to the tapes, but mustering the courage to stick the first one in the big TIAC audio deck. In that moment of hesitation, he's sure he can smell his wife's perfume, even in the soundproofed and air-filtered environment of the studio. In that moment of hesitation, he is positive he isn't alone, that someone or something is standing just outside the studio door, looking in at him through the glass upper half. And that is, in fact, the absolute truth. Blessed with sight as we are, we can see what Henry cannot. We want to tell him what's out there, to lock the studio door. For the love of God, lock it now. But we can only watch. Henry reaches for the play button on the tape deck. Then his finger changes course and hits the intercom toggle instead. Hello? Is anyone out there? The figure standing in Henry's living room, looking in at him the way someone might look into an aquarium at a single exotic fish, makes no sound. The last of the sun's on the other side of the house, and the living room is becoming quite dark, Henry being understandably forgetful when it comes to turning on the lights. Elmer Jesperson's amusing bee slippers, not that they amuse us much under these circumstances, are just about the brightest things out there. Hello? Anyone? The figure looking in through the glass half of the studio door is grinning. In one hand, it is holding the hedge clippers from Henry's garage. Last chance, Henry says. And when there's still no response, he becomes the Wisconsin rat, shrieking into the intercom, trying to startle whatever's out there into revealing itself. Come on now, honey! Come on now, you motherfucker! Talk to Ratty! The figure peering in at Henry recoils, as a snake might recoil when its prey makes a feint, but it utters no sound. From between the grinning teeth comes a leathery old tongue, wagging and poking in derision. This creature has been into the perfume that Mrs. Morton has never had the heart to remove from the vanity in the little powder room adjacent to the master bedroom. And now Henry's visitor reeks of my sin. Henry decides it's all just his imagination playing him up again. Always such a mistake, Morris Rosen would have told him had Morris been there. And hits play with the tip of his finger. He hears a throat-clearing sound. And then Arnold Hrabowski identifies himself. The fisherman interrupts him before he can even finish. Hello, asswipe. Henry rewinds, listens again. Hello, asswipe. Rewinds and listens yet again. Hello, asswipe. Yes, he has heard this voice before. He's sure of it. But where? The answer will come. Answers of this sort always do. Eventually. And getting there is half the fun. Henry listens, enrapt. His fingers dance back and forth over the tape deck's buttons like the fingers of a concert pianist over the keys of a Steinway. The feeling of being watched slips from him, although the figure outside the studio door, the thing wearing the bee slippers and holding the hedge clippers, never moves. Its smile has faded somewhat. A sulky expression is growing on its aged face. There is confusion in that look, and perhaps the first faint trace of fear. The old monster doesn't like it that the blind fish in the aquarium should have captured its voice. Of course, it doesn't matter. Maybe it's even part of the fun. But if it is, it's Mr. Munshun's fun, not its fun. And their fun should be the same, shouldn't it? You have an emergency, not me, you. Not me, you, Henry says. The mimicry is so good, it's weird. A little bit of sauerkraut in your salad, my friend, yeah? Your worst nightmare. Abala. I'm the fisherman. Henry listening intent. He lets the tape run a while, then listens to the same phrase 4 times over.
Kiss my scrot, you monkey. Kiss my scrot, you monkey. You monkey. Monkey.
No, not monkey. The voice is actually saying mungy. Mungy.
I don't know where you are now, but you grew up in Chicago, Henry murmurs. South Side, and
warmth on his face. Suddenly he remembers warmth on his face. Why is that, friends and neighbors? Why is that, oh great wise ones?
You're no better than a monkey on a stick.
Monkey on a stick. Monkey. Monkey, Henry says. He's rubbing his temples with the tips of his fingers now. Monkey on a stick. Monkey on a stick. Who said that?
He plays the 911. Kiss my scrot, you monkey.
He plays his memory. You're no better than a monkey on a stick.
Warmth on his face. Heat? Light? Both?
Henry pops out the 911 tape and sticks in the one Jack brought today.
Hello, Judy. Are you Judy today or are you Sophie? The Abala sends his best, and Gorg says, caw, caw, caw.
Husky, phlegmy laughter.
Ty says hello, too. Your little boy is very lonely.
When Tyler Marshall's weeping, terrified voice booms through the speakers, Henry winces and fast forwards.
There will be more murders.
The accent much thicker now, a burlesque, a joke. Cats and Jammer kids meet the Wolfman, but somehow even more revealing because of that.
They're little children, harvested like weed, harvested like...
Harvested like a monkey on a stick, Henry says. Monkey, harvested.
Who are you, you son of a bitch? There are whips in hell and change in Sheol.
But it's almost vips in hell, almost chens in Sheol.
Vips, chens, monkey on a stick, a stig.
You're no better in... Henry begins. And then, all at once, another line comes to him.
Lady McGowan's nightmare, that one's good.
A bad nightmare of what? Vips in hell? Chens in Sheol? Mungies on sticks?
My God, Henry says softly. Oh, my God. The dance. He was at the dance.
Now it all begins to fall into place. How stupid they have been. How criminally stupid. The boy's bike. It had been right there. Right there, for Christ's sake. They were all blind men. Make them all umps.
But he was so old, Henry whispers.
And senile. How are we supposed to guess such a man could be the fisherman? Other questions follow this one. If the fisherman is a resident at Maxton Elder Care, for instance, where in God's name could he have stashed Ty Marshall? And how is the bastard getting around French Landing? Does he have a car somewhere?
Doesn't matter, Henry murmurs. Not now, anyway. Who is he and where is he? Those are the things that matter.
The warmth on his face, his mind's first effort to locate the fisherman's voice in time and place, had been the spotlight, of course. Symphonic stand spotlight, the pink of ripening berries. And some woman, some nice old woman,
Mr. Stan, yoo-hoo, Mr. Stan,
had asked him if he took requests. Only before Stan could reply, a voice as flat and hard as 2 stones grinding together,
I was here first, old woman,
had interrupted. Flat and hard, and with that faint Germanic harshness that said Southside Chicago, probably 2nd or even 3rd generation. Not was here first, not old woman, but those telltale V's had been lurking, hadn't they?
Ah, yes. Monkey, Henry says, looking straight ahead,
looking straight at Charles Burnside, had he only known it.
Stig, harvested, hasta la vista, baby.
Was that what it came down to in the end? A dotty old maniac who sounded a bit like Arnold Schwarzenegger? Who was the woman? If he can remember her name, he can call Jack, or Dale if Jack's still not answering his phone, and put an end to French Landing's bad dream.
Lady McGowan's nightmare. That one's good.
Nightmare, Henry says. Then adjusting his voice,
nightmare.
Once again, the mimicry is good. Certainly too good for the old codger standing outside the studio door. He is now scowling bitterly and gnashing the hedge clippers in front of the glass. How can the blind man in there sound so much like him? It's not right. It's completely improper. The old monster longs to cut the vocal cords right out of Henry Layden's throat. Soon, he promises himself, he will do that, and eat them. Sitting in the swivel chair, drumming his fingers nervously on the gleaming oak in front of him, Henry recalls the brief encounter at the bandstand. Not long into the Strawberry Fest dance this had been. Tell me your name and what you'd like to hear.
I am Alice Weathers, and Moonglow, please, by Benny Goodman.
Alice Weathers, Henry says. That was her name. And if she doesn't know your name, my homicidal friend, then I'm a monkey on a stick. He starts to get up, and that is when something, begins to knock, very softly, on the glass upper half of the door. Bear Girl has drawn close, almost against her will, and now she, Jack, Doc, and the bees are gathered around the sofa. Mouse has sunk halfway into it. He looks like a person dying badly in quicksand. Well, Jack thinks there's no quicksand, but he's dying badly, all right. Guess there's no question about that. Listen up, Mouse tells them. The black goo is forming at the corners of his eyes again. Worse, it's trickling from the corners of his mouth. The stench of decay is stronger than ever as Mouse's inner workings give up the struggle. Jack is frankly amazed that they've lasted as long as they have. You talk, Beezer says. We'll listen. Mouse looks at Doc.
When I finish, give me the fireworks, the Cadillac dope, understand?
You want to get out ahead of whatever it is you've got? Mouse nods. I'm down with that, Doc agrees. You go out with a smile on your face.
Doubt that, bro, but I'll give it a try.
Mouse shifts his reddening gaze to Beezer.
When it's done, wrap me up in one of the nylon tents that are in the garage. Stick me in the tub. I'm betting that by midnight you'll be able to wash me down the drain like so much beer foam. I'd be careful, though. Don't touch what's left.
Bear Girl bursts into tears.
Don't cry, darling, Mouse says. I'm going to get out ahead. Doc promised. Bees?
Right here, buddy.
You have a little service for me, okay? Read a poem. The one by Auden. The one that always used to frost your balls.
Thou shalt not read the Bible for its prose, Beezer says. He's crying.
You got it, Mousy. Play some Dead. Ripple, maybe. And make sure you're full enough at Kingsland to christen me good and proper into the next life. Guess there won't be any grave for you to piss on, but do the best you can.
Jack laughs at that. He can't help it. And this time it's his turn to catch the full force of Mouse's crimson eyes.
Promise me you'll wait until tomorrow to go out there, cop.
Mouse, I'm not sure I can do that.
You gotta. Go out there tonight. You won't have to worry about the devil, dog. The other things in the woods around that house. The other things.
The red eyes roll horribly. Black stuff trickles into Mouse's beard like tar. Then he somehow forces himself to go on.
The other things in those woods will eat you like candy.
I think that's a chance I'll have to take, Jack says, frowning. There's a little boy somewhere.
Safe,
Mouse whispers. Jack raises his eyebrows, unsure if he's heard Mouse right. And even if he has, can he trust what he's heard? Mouse has some powerful, evil poison working in him. So far, he's been able to withstand it, to communicate in spite of it.
But safe for a little while, Mouse says. Not from everything. There's things that might still get him, I suppose. But for the time being, he's safe from Mr. Munching. Is that his name? Munching?
Munshun, I think. How do you know it? Mouse favors Jack with a smile of surpassing eeriness. It is the smile of a dying sibyl. Once more he manages to touch his forehead, and Jack notes with horror that the man's fingers are now melting into one another and turning black from the nails down.
Got it up here, man. Got it all up here. Told you that. And listen, it's better the kid should get eaten by some giant bug or rock crab over there where he is than that you should die trying to rescue him. If you do that, the Abala will wind up with the kid for sure. That's what your friend says.
What friend? Doc asks suspiciously.
Never mind, Mouse says. Hollywood knows, don't you, Hollywood?
Jack nods reluctantly. It's Speedy, of course, or Parkus, if you prefer.
Wait until tomorrow, Mouse says. High noon, when the sun's strongest in both worlds. Promise.
At first, Jack can say nothing. He's torn in something close to agony.
It'd be almost full dark before he could get back out Highway 35 anyway, Bear Girl says quietly.
And there's bad shit in those woods, all right, Doc says. Makes the stuff in that Blair Witch Project look fucking tame. I don't think you want to try it in the dark. Not unless you got a death wish, that is.
When you're done, Mouse whispers, when you're done, if any of you are left, burn the place to the ground. That hole, that tomb, burn it to the ground. Do you hear me? Close the door.
Yeah, Beezer says. Heard and understood, buddy.
Last thing, Mouse says.
He's speaking directly to Jack now.
You may be able to find it, but I think I got something else you need. It's a word. It's powerful to you because of something you touched once a long time ago. I don't understand that part.
But it's all right, Jack tells him. I do. What's the word, Mouse?
For a moment, he doesn't think Mouse will, in the end, be able to tell him. Something is clearly struggling to keep him from saying the word. But in this struggle, Mouse comes out on top. It is, Jack thinks, very likely his life's last W.
Diyamba, Mouse says. Now you, Hollywood, you say it.
Diyamba, Jack says. And a row of weighty paperbacks slides from one of the makeshift shelves at the foot of the couch. They hang there in the dimming air, hang, hang, and then drop to the floor with a crash. Bear Girl voices a little scream.
Don't forget it, Mouse says. You're gonna need it.
How? How am I going to need it?
Mouse shakes his head wearily.
Don't. No.
Beezer reaches over Jack's shoulder and takes the pitiful little scribble of map.
You're going to meet us tomorrow morning at the sandbar, he tells Jack. Get there by 11:30, and we should be turning into that goddamned lane right around noon. In the meantime, maybe I'll just hold on to this. A little insurance policy to make sure you do things Mouse's way.
Okay, Jack says. He doesn't need the map to find Chummy Burnside's black house. But Mouse is almost certainly right. It's probably not the sort of place you want to tackle after dark. He hates to leave Time Marshall in the Furnace Lands. It feels wrong in a way that's almost sinful. But he has to remember that there's more at stake here than one little boy lost.
Beezer, are you sure you want to go back there?
Hell no, I don't want to go back, Beezer says, almost indignantly. But something killed my daughter. My daughter! And it got here from there. You want to tell me you don't know that's true?
Jack makes no reply. Of course it's true. And of course he wants Doc and the bees with him when he turns up the lane to Black House. If they can bear to come, that is.
Diyamba, he thinks. Diyamba. Don't forget.
He turns back to the couch. Mouse, do you know? Doc says.
Guess he won't need the Cadillac dope after all.
Huh? Jack peers at the big brewer biker stupidly. He feels stupid. Stupid and exhausted.
Nothing ticking but his watch, Doc says. And then he begins to sing.
After a moment, Beezer joins in, then Bear Girl. Jack steps away from the couch with a thought queerly similar to Henry's. How did it get late so early? Just how in hell did that happen? In heaven there is no beer, that's why we drink it here, and when we're gone from here. Jack tiptoes across the room. On the far side, there's a lighted Kingsland Premium Golden Pale Ale bar clock. Our old friend, who is finally looking every year of his age, and not quite so lucky, peers at the time with disbelief, not accepting it until he has compared it to his own watch. Almost 8. He has been here for hours. Almost dark, and the fisherman still out there someplace, not to mention his otherworldly playmates. The Yamba, he thinks again as he opens the door. And as he steps out onto the splintery porch and closes the door behind him, he speaks aloud with great sincerity into the darkening day. Speedy, I'd like to wring your neck.